attitude. We are going to energize the country.
We need to wake up and smell the coffee.
The independence case is a powerful one.
Another future is possible, but we've got to fight for it.
Order!
Hello and welcome to the Debated Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Will. And in this episode, I'm delighted to be joined once again by the one and only William Kajani, the political analyst and sporting previewer for Star Sports Betting. Welcome back to the podcast, William.
I'm most pleased to be back. Great to be here again.
It's great to have you here again. And the first question that I really have to ask is, we've got a by-election coming up in a few days. What are the odds looking like for who's going to win that by-election?
Amazingly, well, not amazingly, the Lib Dems are favourite, but amazingly, they are very, very short now. To put this into context, I'm going to quote some fractional odds, and then what I'll do is I'll sort of put those into percentages so that hopefully if you're listening to this and you don't bet often, you'll be able to understand. But we are now 4-9 that the Lib Dems win. They are our favourites. They are also the best backed party in that by-election. Of course, Helen Morgan, their candidate, been out campaigning a lot. Puns have really come for them. We are 4-9 for the Lib Dems. We are 13-8 for the Conservatives. This might raise some eyebrows, depending on who you've been listening to. We are 50-1 for Labour and Ben Wood, 80-1 for Reform UK, and 200-1 for the Green Party. So those are the runners and riders, essentially, that we're focusing on, really.
Isn't it quite extraordinary that you've got the Lib Dems so high, as you mentioned, given that the last time that the Lib Dems came second to the Conservatives in North Shropshire, it is a seat that's only really ever in modern times been held by the Conservatives. You have to go back to the 1830s to find a time when it was held by a party other than the Conservatives on the two-seat system that existed at the time. The Lib Dems have only come second in this seat in 2010. What do you think it is that is putting such confidence both in the markets and the Liberal Democrats themselves that they will have a chance to win this by-election?
Well, first things first, the governments and the Conservatives are very much completely tarred by association, just in the sense that when this originally started, the Lib Dems were 5-1 outside. You know, there was a thinking that they target the seat or whatever, but they were, you know, 16% chances, and the Tories were 1-4, which was 80%. What's happened to drive such a big change to the point now that the Lib Dems are considered 70% chances with us, and the Tories now about 38%, is a multiple number of factors. Firstly, I do think that it started with the Paterson scandal. Mm-hmm. He actually had a reasonable amount of support from people who thought was a good constituency MP, but the association and the impression left there was deeply damaging. And that's what the kick-started thing, because it gave the Lib Dems, who, after called Cheshire and Amersham earlier this year, and after, in general, really putting a lot of energy into get-out-the-vote efforts in this year's by-elections, were already looking at the seat and already looking to run things down. I think it's fair to say you would have expected the Tory majority, hypothetically, let's say in a scenario where they win on Thursday, you'd expect the majority to come down because the candidate parachuted in doesn't have name recognition or the relationship with the constituents that Paterson did. What you wouldn't have expected, however, would be for evidence to come out that Downing Street staff had not only one, not two, not three, not four, not five, not six, but not seven, but eight potential gatherings in Downing Street during last year's winter lockdown. And you would not have expected, I think, 2 weeks solid, I think, of negative coverage in all of the print media and also all the broadcast media, whether Tory or Labour supporting outlets in the papers, just relentlessly attacking Johnson. And whilst he's taking the brunt of it, by association, the government is also taking a hit as well. Again, I think because of presumed hypocrisy. In amongst this, you also have a situation where the Conservative candidate, Dr. Neil Shastri Hurst, hasn't really been seen very much in comparison to either the Lib Dems' Helen Morgan or indeed Labour's Ben Wood. And then also you have the Johnson coming up to have a visit the day after the old Bexley, the Sidcup by-election win, where his presence wasn't really helpful. He's toxic at the moment there, and you have a situation where the Conservative candidate is pretty absent, hasn't parachuted in, doesn't really know the area well, and two people who do know the area very well are absolutely cracking on and throwing big resources. And I think that combined has led to the situation where you're having these internal poll numbers come back. They're looking really bad for the Tories, and people are reacting to them. And also, the way the stories have been leaked, especially the video, it has had an impact on the local level. And I think that definitely, not only the market, but I think the campaigners on the ground have smelled blood. Mm.
Do you think that this could potentially be a Eastbourne moment for Boris Johnson? Just for those who might not be aware, the 1990 Eastbourne by-election in which the Liberal Democrats won a surprise victory in a seat that had been Conservative for many years was one of the things that was seen to spell the end of Margaret Thatcher's premiership, given the unpopularity of the poll tax, her personal unpopularity, and Labour's lead in the polls at the time. Do you think that this could be an Eastbourne moment if the Lib Dems win North Shropshire?
Yeah, there's the potential for it to be. It was interesting because Stephen Crabbe was on Politics Live just this morning or afternoon, and he said that the idea of a leadership contest during this time was for the birds, which I think, is understandable in the sense that you don't really want to have a leadership election during the current situation. Mm. At the same time, you know, to lose a by-election seat where things are unfavourable, not really in your favour, is sort of understandable. Most governments have that issue periodically from time to time. Mm-hmm. But North Shropshire, it would be different. It would be different even in Chesham and Amersham, which in hindsight had lots of situations that favoured Lib Dems. This is dyed-in-the-wall Tory heartland. It should not really be in the up-for-grabs column in the first place. You can say what you will about by-elections being very different to general elections, which is true, and midterm blues for governments with their voters coming back at subsequent elections, which again has a bit of truth to it. But if you are losing a seat where you previously had 62.8% of votes, it's going to put a lot of Tory MPs on edge. And they're already not happy because they're already taking the brunt of Johnson's decision-making, Downing Street's very chaotic approach to story management, personally anyway. You know, people were furious at the second jobs thing, and they're arguably, I think, even angrier at this. I think the hypocrisy is more direct. It's a repeat, essentially, of Barnard Castle, though I think possibly people might be more upset because whilst the Barnard Castle thing was a stupid manoeuvre, and it was an odd, daft story, and people were really suffering at the time, last Christmas, I think, probably hurt people more. I'm definitely seeing, this is anecdotal, I must say, but I'm seeing more of a personal hurt over these stories than over Barnard Castle, I think because of the emotional difficulty of last Christmas for people. And that's definitely seeding through. So, I mean, no doubt, yeah, absolutely. We already have 60 rebels. That's just on the record, by the way, against the Plan B restrictions. Now you've got a by-election defeat in what used to be a safe Conservative area, and also the polls are now showing consistent Labour leads. There are a lot of Tory MPs who are very worried. So no, there's absolutely every chance it might be an Eastbourne moment. The only thing I'd say is, because we're 6-1 that Boris Johnson leaves this year, there's still a large, part of this premiership left to run. There's 2 years. Labour can keep on being popular and popular, but the next election is still quite a while away. There may not be the need to have a leadership election just yet, particularly again with all the other challenges.
Just on the point of the Barnard Castle comparison, do you think that part of the reason that this has perhaps impacted people more, made them even angrier than with the Barnard Castle incident, is because with Barnard Castle it was one individual, whereas with this, as you mentioned, there are about eight or nine gatherings that are being either investigated or known about. Just the sheer volume of rule breakage and the amount of people involved has probably incensed people even more, because it's not just one individual who can be said to have broken the rules, it's quite a few individuals and consistently broken them.
I agree completely with that. The fake is a very good way of looking at it. Also, it pretty much directly involves the Prime Minister as well. Some people are saying that the Zoom quiz yesterday was a bit of a weaker story than the others. But again, the cumulative effect, you know, to do it once might be considered hypocritical or whatever. This was 8 times. And there is just no doubt about those rules. There was no doubt about the state of the rules at that time. Particularly also see people are in government. They were drafting legislation. And I think that really rankles the people.
Absolutely. And you mentioned a moment ago the odds relating to Boris Johnson leaving. So just to go over the odds in total, what are the odds in terms of Boris Johnson's expected leaving date? And what kind of odds are we seeing for who could be the next Prime Minister once he does leave Downing Street?
Okay, so he is 6-1 to leave this calendar year. And by the way, when we say leave office, it's leave office for any reason. So he could decide to resign. There could be a vote of no confidence in the government. There could be a vote of no confidence in him as Tory leader or whatever. But he's got to leave office. 6-1 for 2021. 11-10 for the next year. So 2022, from January 1st to December 31st. That's... is actually just our second favourite. Our favourite is 10-11 for him to go 2023 or later. And also we have odds on him being the Tory leader at the next general election. We are 4-5. We are also 10-11 that he isn't the Conservative leader at the next election. Again, if you're not familiar with your fractionals, it's pretty... you know, it's pretty evenly balanced basically between the two, which is not really what you'd have expected. Back in October, after he gave the speech at Tory conference, he was, I believe it was 2s on, 1-2, to be the Prime Minister at the next general election, something which I thought was quite big value there. And he looked to have it, you know, all bloody sewed up. So it just shows how quickly things can change. In terms of succeeding him as next Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak is the 2-1 favourite. Keir Starmer is 4-1. Liz Truss is 9-2. Tens Bar, Jeremy Hunt is 10-1. Michael Gove is 10-1. Andy Burnham is 20. Sajid Javid, 20s. Dominic Raab, 25s. Angela Rayner, 33s. James Cleverly, 33s. Priti Patel, 33s. Penny Mordaunt, 40s. So yeah, that's the state of play to replace Johnson, but we've taken lots of money on him going sooner rather than later.
You mentioned earlier that we've seen some consistent Labour leads in the opinion polls over the past few days. We saw some Labour leads at the start of November, but they were intermittent with either ties or Conservative leads. I mean, what do you think that it says about the... consistent Labour lead polling at the moment? Do you think it is solely down to the situation related to the Christmas parties? Do you think it has something to do with the recent shadow cabinet reshuffle? What do you think is motivating this consistent Labour lead that we're seeing in the most recent polls?
I think what's motivating it is a shift away from the Conservatives. I think what you're seeing here is a big Conservative fall and Labour gaining, I think, incremental pieces of support. I saw in one recent poll that they'd taken 10% of Tory voters in 2019. Whether that's 10% of the switchers who went from Labour to Tory, or just 10% of the Tory voters in total, I don't know. I think it's pretty clear that's the case. That is not terrible for Keir Starmer and the Labour Party, but it is not sustainable all the way to an election, particularly if, as example, Johnson left, Sunak was elected Tory leader. I think it's much harder for Keir Starmer to fight Sunak than it is Johnson. But I do also think there are some structural issues which might keep the Tory vote just a little bit suppressed going forward. I'm thinking particularly of cost of living and also inflation, which the two of which are tied together. I also wonder, I know that there tends to be broad support for restrictions when it comes to public health, and they tend to be driven, I think, by people who are more likely to vote Tory. But I wonder if too many of those, in the sense that people lose patience with them as a Tory base, might also see them shifting. But essentially, we've seen a big shift from voted Tory in 2019, or was intending to vote Tory in the Westminster intention polls, to don't know or won't vote. And then I think smaller offshoots to Labour and the Lib Dems and the Reform Party in some cases.
So in terms of the next election, we've discussed obviously some dates. It may be sooner than we think. How do you think that the election campaign will be played out come the next election? Obviously, this is going a few years into the future, but what do you think are going to be the main concerns going forward? Coronavirus certainly seems to be staying around in terms of people's minds and affecting people's lives perhaps longer than the government might have thought it was going to do. So do you think that that's going to be playing a part in the next election? Or do you think it's going to be things like, as you mentioned, the cost of living, house prices, things like that? What do you think is going to dominate the next election campaign?
I can see a future election being mainly fought on the economy. And I see it for a couple of reasons. Firstly, as much as I'd love to be wrong about this, transitioning from a pandemic, which we are very much still in my opinion, to having COVID as an endemic disease, is just fraught with danger and with risk and with setbacks, as we've seen from the Omicron variant. It's not, you cannot just go back to normal overnight, and that will have an impact down the next couple of years. The next thing I think is very important to note is that the Tory offer, or the Tory motivating factor at the 2019 general election, was Brexit. It was very much Brexit. And also, I think, more of an optimistic belief in Britain and what Britain was at the point, and the better message. Whoever is leading the Tories in the 2024 election, if we assume it's then, is going to have a much harder time selling that message. The initial obvious fall that comes to mind is levelling up. Let's continue levelling up. Let's continue reducing inequality between the North and the South in particular, but also straight from the Union and deprived areas of the Southwest, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That's going to be very hard to show a lot for in just the first couple of years. If you get to a situation where public services haven't improved much, and people are paying even more for trains, which aren't faster, and there aren't any bus services or whatever, and roads still haven't been built or whatever, which is entirely possible just because it's tricky to do those things in a short period of time, relatively, you could have real trouble keeping voters who who voted Tory in 2019 for whatever reason, and now don't have an obvious compelling call to. So I think that might be how the next election is decided. I think also competence is probably going to have something to do with it. I think more so than the last election, where both Jeremy Corbyn and Boris Johnson, I think, had large groups of people who just didn't think they were fit to be Prime Minister. And if it's Keir Starmer versus, say, Rishi Sunak, I imagine very much that there will be larger groups who could tolerate either one. So cultures is definitely going to be a watchword.
So in terms of culture, then, do you think that we're going to see more of cultural war type things entering politics and entering the debate? Do you think that we're going to see more discussion related perhaps to immigration? We've got the nationalities bill that is going through the Commons at the moment, going through the Commons and the House of Lords at the moment. Do you think that this is going to be something that we're going to see perhaps more emphasis placed on during the election? In a post-Brexit world, there's going to be more emphasis on relation to migration and immigration, particularly from the Conservatives.
Yes, long story short. And I think we could see it get to some pretty awful heights. I mean, I'd argue it played a reasonably big role in the 2019 election. It was very much an election that was based on large amounts of emotion. And I don't think it's hard to see that happening once again. And I think there could be any amount of issues which by that time would be weaponized. We've seen already the whole range of cultural issues of importance being weaponized in really nasty and ugly ways. I think that our ability to fight misinformation is growing in the sense that we have technology and people understand it more. But I think our vulnerability to it is getting worse, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
We are, if anything, now more susceptible to misinformation and also, I think, very harmful discourse that comes with it. And I think there's a number of sort of cats that have been let firmly out of bags, and I don't think you can put those genies back in those bottles yet. So I expect it to play a big part. It's going to depend a lot on who's leading both parties. You know, I think a Starmer versus Sunak hypothetical match is going to have much less the cultural vibe to it than, say, if Truss was leading the Tories to that election. But I think whoever leads it, it'll be a big part.
I'd like to now turn to the United States, because next year, of course, we have midterm elections coming up, both in the House and the Senate. In terms of the situation that we're seeing in the United States, Joe Biden and the Democrats aren't perhaps as popular as they'd hope to be, particularly going off Biden securing the most votes of any presidential candidate in history at the last presidential election. I mean, how much do you think a part of this is just the continuation of the pandemic and failure to, resolve the pandemic? How much do you think that that's affecting the Democrats and Joe Biden? And also, how much do you think that part of the issues that he's going to face coming up to the midterm elections next year are going to be as a result of the stall that we've seen in the Senate? I mean, it's a 50-50 in the Senate at the moment, which of course makes it very difficult for Democrats to get any legislation passed, because they need all of their bloc to vote as one. And we've seen from the actions of Kirsten Sinema and Joe Manchin that really isn't happening at the moment.
I agree with you, or I agree with the central premise of the question, which is that it's been really difficult for the US or for the Biden administration to kick on and make the sort of progress that most developed countries were seeing in the summer, where the vaccination programs were motoring full steam ahead, and they were having really good effects, and you were seeing a big hitting transmission, hospitalizations, or whatever. And you could have events again, and events that were being held, you know, reasonably safely. But there's a big issue there, which is that the US is just not able to be governed in the same way that other major countries are, because A, it's so vast, and B, that there's so many political differences. Mm. In blue states, you've had higher vaccine take-up, you've had less severe outcomes, that program has worked, and as such, they've had the economic benefits or whatever. But in red states, where you have to remember, plenty of people don't believe Biden is a legitimate president, mm. they believe the election was stolen from Trump, you've had much lower compliance with all sorts of measures. Everything from the social distancing measures to the vaccination drives. And also, I think, just in general, public health measures as well. Not to mention, just a pre-exposed or you know, a premeditated hatred of Biden and the Democratic Party particularly. So it's always hard for a president, I think, nowadays to have a higher approval rating. Mm. I think the days of like hitting 55 or whatever are probably gone, or like hitting 60, I think they're gone. The issue for Biden is it's tricky to reverse this. He got the infrastructure bill partly through, and that's big, but you don't see the effects of that imminently. Mm. And they're geographically spread, and it's tricky. And they just seem to be bogged down in quite a lot. There are the traditional problems of government, which just hurt them more because it's in the middle of the term, and it's difficult. And then you are facing an issue where, once again, a new variant threatens to wreck everything. And I think they will get more of the blame for that in America than they would have here, mm. where people were broadly very understanding of the issue the government had to deal with, even if they didn't necessarily like how the government were performing with it.
Mm-hmm. And of course, with those midterm elections as well, we are potentially going to see the Republicans return to a majority in the House. And we've had individuals like Matt Gaetz suggest that if that were to occur, then they would select Donald Trump to be Speaker of the House. Now, if Trump were to become Speaker of the House, what impact do you think that would have on American politics?
It would be quite stark, I think, because you have to remember he would begin to become a figure that many of the media outlets in the US would feel compelled to cover again. And that then begins to drive its own cycles and have its own outsized effect on American discourse. Mm. And also, you have to remember, he's running for 2024. In my opinion, he's running. I think he's got a big chance of winning, distressingly. How obvious is it going to be that he will use that as a campaign vehicle if it was to happen? And then you get into the situation where you were now 4 years ago. We don't want to, this guy's running for president in the United States. Let's cover his rallies. The ratings are great. I think people will have more of a cautious mind in terms of paying attention to him now, but he'll be a Speaker of the House. He'll have to be covered. And that's going to be a tremendous challenge. And then you get into the point of, he's going to take all that oxygen and do what he does. And he's going to take away airtime from other Republican candidates. And he's probably going to take away a lot of airtime for the president and the administration. Mm. So it's, if it was to happen, it'd be a massive, massive test of the American democratic system, which is creaking at the seams at the moment, in my opinion. It's not on firm ground, in my opinion.
Mm. We're coming towards the end of the podcast, and as always, it's great to have you on, William. And I have one final question for you. Obviously, we've discussed a variety of things, both the UK political scene and the US political scene, and Omicron is certainly affecting both. But regardless of that, we are in the month of December. Christmas is quickly approaching us. It will soon be Christmas. So my final question to you is this. If you had to get a single Christmas present for both the Prime Minister and the Leader of the Opposition, what Christmas presents would you get for Boris Johnson and Keir Starmer?
A brilliant, brilliant question. For Boris Johnson, I would get him, I'd have a special book printed, and in it would be the Nolan Principles and then the Ministerial Code. And he could have that as a special hardback. For Keir Starmer, this is a bit tricky. I've got two presents for Keir Starmer. The first thing I'd do would be to get him, I think, some seminar training on statutory sick pay. Just so that he knows it's probably a message that he should continue to hammer home. When I say continue, he hasn't really done very much of that on Twitter, but he did speak up about it on Mar, I noticed. Mm-hmm. Labour isn't going to leverage that against the government for their Plan B rules, which I think is a bit of a shame, considering that they could turn the heat up just a bit. And I mm-hmm. think it's important that the Labour Party does shout out a lot about sick pay, because if we are headed for the worst, if you're headed for a situation, and we already are asking people to stay home, and to a harsh degree in Scotland, if you're heading for a situation where we need large amounts of people to stay home again, they have to be compensated for it. Mm. We've been through this, not once, but twice. And if you live in the North, actually, you had four or five lockdowns, not just three or four. I begin to lose count. That'd be your first thing. And then secondly, do you know, actually, I'd get him the Ford report. I'd get him the Ford report. I've changed for a really topical answer. I was going to get him one of those fancy Arsenal tops they got a new collection of, because he's a diehard gooner. But I'd just get him the Ford report. He looks like he could do with reading that. That could be his holiday reading. That appears to drifted into non-existence, but that's in the Christmas satchel for both the Prime Minister and the Leader of the Opposition.
I think that those are some great presents for both of them, and I'm sure that they could learn a lot from those presents that you'd be dishing out, William. Thank you again for coming on the podcast. If people want to find out more about you, follow your exploits, where should they go to find out more about you and to follow you?
Okay, so I will be covering either the Rebellion tomorrow or North Shropshire. Do forgive me, I am being buzzed constantly. You can go and follow me on Twitter at KEEJAYOV3, KEEJAYOV3, or just type in William Kajani, second name, KEDJANYI. I'll be recording a by-election preview, sort of really specific one for Star Sports. I'll be hopefully posting a few political videos out and about, either in Westminster or North Shropshire or both. You can find those by going to at StarSports_bet. So at StarSports_bet. And all of our best content will be on there.
Excellent. Thank you once again for coming on the podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the podcast. If you've enjoyed it, you can subscribe to us on iTunes, Spotify, Podbeam, and Amazon Music. You can also follow us on Twitter, at Debated Podcast, like us on Facebook, Debated Podcast, and if you'd like to get in touch with us, whether about appearing on an episode of the podcast, or commenting on an episode that you've listened to, you can do so at thedebatedpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you for listening. I hope you listen to the next one.